Thank you for joining us, and I'm here with my friend Omar Abubakar, who is probably the nation's number one expert on the use of opioids and pain treatments in oral surgery. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Oral and Maxillofacial Surgery at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thank you, Omar.
Thank you.
It's great for you to be here.
Thank you for having me.
And explaining all of the news and what we've heard about risk factors and in opioid administration to dental patients, especially patients who have had wisdom teeth removed. And you're the expert in that. Can you explain what's going on in that field?
So one of the high risk of exposure to opioids is age, because young people, especially those who present to the oral surgery office for wisdom teeth or for some dental procedure, usually they are opioid naive patients, meaning they have no exposure, previous exposure to opioid. So the first exposure could be detrimental in having them progress into what we call long-term use, and from long-term use to misuse and possible addiction. So in the population of patients that oral surgeon prescribed medication for, is a large percentage of them are from that population. So they are by definition a higher risk population for prescription opioid. And I think oral surgeons and dentists should be aware of that. That is just not like other patients, adult patients. And I think that's where the risk comes from.
So they're a high risk, and the standard of practice before the opioid epidemic was you take somebody's wisdom teeth out and you'd give them opioids. Is that pretty
correct?
Much it?
That's correct. There's no concern, not intentional, but naive knowledge from oral surgeons and dentists that this population of patients would not be addicted the same way as, you know, 50-year-old don't get addicted with short-term use. We're finding that this patient exposure, this young people exposure to this addictive substance, even on a short-term basis, is detrimental compared to that of older population.
So how many, what would a typical prescription for opioids look like in the old days when they take your wisdom teeth and they give you a script? What would it look like?
Yeah, the average number of tablets per prescription that was given to young people, even the initial prescription, is about 20 tablets. Some people write for more, some people write for less. Believe it or not, even with what we have now, there are still some people who prescribe that number of tablets. So the word out there is not completely among all oral surgeon dentists that this 20 tablets should be, you know, thing of the past. It's not thing of the past. In many places, it's the present. I think for those who are educated on the issue or in contact with the literature, with the culture, what's going on in our country, have changed their views to some degree. And some of them gradually decrease the number of tablets. Some of them eliminate opioid altogether from their practice.
So the one reason to change prescribing practices among oral surgeons would just be to reduce the number of opioid prescriptions out there, because they tend to find a user. They tend to stay around in people's houses and shelves, medicine cabinets, and so forth. But another that from your work is that really you can manage this kind of pain without giving opioids. And you've presented an alternative approach.
Yes, and credit goes to other institutions and other oral surgeons around the country who have done the same thing. So it was just not my own experience that depending on opioid as a first line has become part of the past in my practice and in many other practices, that the first line of treatment would be non-steroidal, long-term local anesthetic, preemptive non-steroidal, combination of non-steroidal and acetaminophen. So there are many combinations before you get to the last resort, and the last resort would be opioid. And it's been successful. I think the barrier to changing a lot of the practices, it's probably a mental barrier more so than a practical or scientific one. The evidence base coming out telling us that the majority of this patient could do without the opioid. And those who would need opioid for a short period of time, and probably a minimal number of tablets, on the average between 7 and 8 tablets.
That's a big difference.
And a difference that may consequential, because even if they use those, they found that the average number of tablets, when they give them 20 and check on them a week later to ask them what's left, they calculated, and what they use is about between 6 and 8 tablets. So that meant even when they use the opioid, that's all you need. So that meant that if we give 6 or 7, and even if they use them, there's nothing left behind, and which is the key to all this, is that this leftover that could be shared with friend in high school or party, and this is where the troubles come from, is sharing the excess leftover opioid.
So the first reason to change practice is public health reason, because we're in the midst of an opioid epidemic. The second is there's alternatives that are not opioids that are equally effective. And the third, from your own data, is untreated, how many people will what's the natural history of that pain? Is it so incapacitating, or does it last for such a long period of time? What is the natural history?
I think what we need to remember is that the pain following third molar surgery or wisdom teeth is different from one individual to the other. And I think that dictates that each person or each patient should be treated differently. Some may need only ibuprofen or non-steroidal. Some may need the combination of both. Some may need a backup rescue medication of opioids. And I think the natural history is that within 2 days, the level of pain is manageable with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent. That in combination, either alone or in combination of acetaminophen. So even when opioid is needed, is not needed beyond the first 24 to 48 hours. And therefore, the expectations if we give somebody a prescription, they're going to use them for the whole week is not an accurate one.
You know, it's remarkable to sit with you, and here you are an OMF surgeon, and you were always talking about substance use disorder and evaluating the whole patient. Does that apply to you? You teach your students at VCU to take comprehensive addiction histories, and, you know, give us some advice on that.
Oh, yes. And it's fulfilling and gratifying, because the outcome for young patient, for young students and residents, people who are still in training, is very positive one. And to the extent that their management of pain, they come out, graduate from dental school and from the residency with different opinions than those who graduated in an earlier generation. We talk about treating pain using pharmacological agent, whether it's non-steroidal or combination with somebody else or opioid, it's only part of the formula. It's just like the middle of that is the pharmacological, but the periphery and the introduction would be the discussion with the patient and the family before even the procedure start, and then you close it at the end by another discussion with the patient and the family about expectations of pain and how we manage it. And what the expectation, and what happened if the prescribed medication doesn't work, then here's what we're going to do. So it's not, I think, assuring the patient and the family that nobody's going to suffer through the process. And in my mind, it's really balancing between compassion for patient care by managing their pain and not suffering, and patient safety. And it's a balance that's easy to achieve, and it's achievable. And it behoves us not to do it every single time with every single patient. Patient need to know that you are not letting them out there suffering. And to me, that is in itself assuring to patient that no matter what discussion you have with them, they'll trust you, that even if you say you're not going to have any medication, there is a chance that they trust you on that and they will go along with it. And I find that rewarding, actually, because I have this fear throughout my whole career that if I don't give them medication, they're going to be upset with me. And if they, you know, and if I If I enter the discussion about not getting opioid, they would suspect or think that I'm suspicious of them or their kids. That is not the case anymore. The case is that the public are much more open-minded, willing, and trusting to what the doctors say. And that is including, you know, pain management in a comprehensive way.
So like at the medical school, you teach about addictions, and you know about addiction capabilities in your community and state. It would maybe be unusual for people to hear that a prominent OMF surgeon and dentist would be referring people for addiction treatment and knowing about addiction resources like you do. Is that something you'd encourage all doctors to do?
I encourage, of course, as I said before, I came to it from a different angle. Believe it or not, I wrote two textbooks, and none of them was an opioid. And the last thing I thought to gonna be is talking about opioid. But I came to it in ways that through the compassion for patient and being a good doctor. I always wanted to be a good doctor, and I find that being non-judgmental, that's combining therapies and talking to patient and including patient into the treatment, and the role of a stigma and role of medical professional and interaction with medical profession is very rewarding and made me better doctor. You know, it's a hard way to get to it, but made me better doctor. I do refer a patient to treatment because just like if I find out that they have diabetes or have hypertension or heart disease, I refer them for treatment. I figured this is another chronic disease. As a culture, there's nothing that is not chronic. Every disease is a chronic disease, and a chronic disease that we could survive, it's treatable, and should be no stigma attached to it. We don't have a stigma attached to many of the other chronic disease, and an addiction should be just like that. And because of that, I don't hesitate to discuss with the patient, to refer them to primary care, or to their doctor, or to addiction medicine. I made myself aware of the resources. I know the director of some of the addiction treatment clinics in town, and I made an effort to know them in person. So when I refer a patient, I give them my business card, and I say, I'm right on the back of it, the name of the doctor and the phone number. And it's very rewarding because I feel like I'm not just treating the mouth anymore. I'm treating the whole well-being of the patient.
Well, that's just the way it should be. It's the ideal. I'm not just treating the mouth anymore. I mean, that's, I'll remember that.
Yes.
And I'm sure it is really gratifying. Yeah. You've saved a lot of people's lives.
If I saved only one life, it would be all worth it.
So there's a recent study that says if we don't do anything about the opioid crisis, we'll lose 500,000 more Americans. We lose 50,000 plus a year. And that's a number to people. But almost everyone knows someone who's been impacted by addiction. And many of us know someone who's died as a result of their opioid use. And sadly, that's happened in your family.
Yes. And in fact, I came to this issue through that, because when I found out my 21-year-old son was addicted, it was total shock to me. I had a total shock to me because I didn't know what the signs before, because I may have, if I knew that, I would have recognized it. And my son went through treatment, so it kind of allowed me to think, you know, there's a treatment for it. And it really through my son that I learned to some degree the compassion for the disease and compassion for patients affected by the disease. My son we find out that he was addicted to heroin. He had shoulder surgery, and he was prescribed medications about 6 months before. They may have some other issues maybe with alcohol, but really he was a functional kid, that there's no evidence of any major substance use disorder. But 6 months after his shoulder surgery is when I found out that he was addicted to heroin. And we admitted him for treatment and went on to recovery and then relapsed and died. And I remember vividly during his recovery time, we had many conversations about addiction as a disease. And he almost taught me about the disease. as if he was going to introduce me to a topic of not of my choosing. And I remember, if I may tell the story, that I asked him when I first found out who gave him the medicine or who gave him the heroin. And he said, it doesn't matter, Dad. So I pushed him until he gave me a name. And then he, just a name, code name, I suspect, then went on, during recovery, came back and we had a conversation and he said, you remember the kid I told you about? He brought it up, so-and-so. I said, yeah. And he said, he died. And I said, good. And then he said, Dad, that's not right. You know, he's an addict, he's sick, he's a patient, and he has a mom, and he has a dad. I'll never forget that, because, you know, I'm a doctor, I'm not supposed to be saying yes for somebody who died. I'm supposed to be into business of saving lives. I'm supposed to be, you know, compassionate. That after he died, after my son died, I cried for that, for my son, and for that kid, I'm sorry. But you know, it went on to go to school to find out, what is it that I'm so clueless about, that I was so not even a doctor? And I went to school for a year, an addiction study, graduate school addiction study. I learned this is a chronic disease, just like a lot of the other chronic diseases. And I learned that there's a treatment for it, and these are patients, and we, all the things, and it triggered me to go and educate people that are ignorant as me before I was subjected to that tragedy. And really, this is what I do now. Like I said, I travel everywhere I asked, and I don't keep my honorarium, if I say this, I put it into a fund for education about addiction, because I said it'd make me sick in my stomach to teach, to make a living out of my own tragedy. But I'm interested into the education. I'm gonna teach and educate everybody who listen about the issue for as long as I do, because I don't want one parent, I know that parents or not, I don't want parents to go through what I went through. And that was my journey. Sorry about that.
You know, thank you very much for being so open and honest and sharing, but in addition, for your new life's work, which is meaningful, and you're having a huge impact, and you have a voice that is more than just a technical expert, it's an emotional and experiential expert.
Yes.
Like, people forget when they talk about the 50,000 people who've died, what is left behind. And it's a lot of trauma and grief and sadness, and everyone's affected by that.
I do speak, Mark, thank you for giving me the opportunity, because I speak on behalf of the mother who may not even have a TV interview, for the father that out there that ashamed of telling people that his son died. I want people to go out and speak about the issue, because as long as we hide it, as long as the stigma continue, and as long as the stigma continue, people are not going to seek treatment, and when they seek treatment, they treat it differently. And I speak on behalf, not only myself, but on behalf of every parents who had suffered the tragedy that I suffered and traveled the journey that I traveled.
So I'd like to thank everybody for being with us for this educational program, and for my friend Omar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here and helping us understand the important role that OMF surgeons and dentists might play in prevention and education, as well as the important role of medical education, and then the important role of the survivors in telling the story and making sure that it makes a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. It's great to be here with Dr. Siegfried Schmidt, who is a longtime colleague and friend of mine from the University of Florida College of Medicine in Gainesville, where he's a professor and a leader in community health and family medicine. We've worked together in drug prevention and intervention and education of medical students, interns, and residents for many years, and probably he might even remember that I started moving from neuroscience in my first clinical department was in community health and family medicine in smoking cessation. So it's great to have you here today.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here and being invited, so yeah. Thank you.
It's really good. So, you know, this is an important project for us, and you're an important expert in having experience in pain and pain evaluation and mm-hmm. opioid use. Where do family medicine practitioners fit? I mean, do they prescribe a lot of opioids?
Yes, family medicine doctors actually are responsible for about 50% of all prescriptions for opioids. When you look at other subspecialties, 50%, that's quite a bit. We are responsible for half of all the opioid prescriptions out there. And there is a reason for it, because primary care, in my eyes, is actually very well suited to be treating patients with chronic pain. Primary care physicians are trained in chronic disease management, and this is what you need, because chronic pain, unfortunately, is not something that goes away. There's really no cure for it. So they integrate already the disease management aspects. They coordinate the care with others. So we're kind of the medical home for others. We know the patients probably best. Over the years, they get to know us. We look into the whole person and really look into the biopsychosocial aspects of the patient. It's very important for chronic conditions, because unfortunately we don't have a silver bullet like maybe the orthopedist with a knee replacement. We have a management approach that we can offer.
Yeah, well, so the person might go to the emergency department and then they'd come back to you, or they go to an orthopedic surgeon and come back to you. And so when you're dealing with pain and pain management, how do you approach that?
So a good aspect is we do a good history. When we're faced with a patient in chronic pain, they had some pain for a while, we actually use some tools to make sure that we have appropriate evaluation of the patient. There are tools that have been developed to actually be able to know if these patients have a risk, for example, for opioid addiction or others. And we look into what we call comorbidities. We look into depression, anxiety, and many other things. So there are a lot of misconceptions, unfortunately, out there for doctors that I'm dealing with, other my colleagues in family medicine. They feel that these patients are kind of difficult, and I believe that it's due to misconceptions, because if you connect with these patients, they're very grateful that you're actually helping them, even though you can't get rid of their pain, but you're able to manage the pain with them.
So, I mean, physicians and training, I mean, we want to help people. And the person might come in and say, doc, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. Can't you help me? And how do you approach that?
So if the patient brings up the pain, there are two ways of doing this. First of all, unfortunately, primary care physicians have not been trained in chronic pain management over the years. Many did not have the training in medical school, and then they did, unfortunately, not get the training in residency programs, neither. So there is a little bit of a lack of knowledge. However, they have everything they need already, as I was talking about, and they just need to add a couple of things to the armamentarium. So their history that we do with any other problem, like diabetes or anything else, just needs to be a few aspects we'll need to add to it. So what I usually suggest is you do an addiction risk evaluation. There are tools now, for example, the opioid risk tool, which can easily be integrated in the history. And we, in family medicine, already use things like a PHQ-9 or a GAD-7. It's an anxiety screen that we look into comorbidities. And when you do this, you can already kind of estimate a little bit, is this patient someone who is actually just trying to get opioids from you, or this patient actually has legitimate pain issues and then you can make an appropriate comprehensive plan for those.
For the like opioid risk tool, is that something that all doctors should be aware of or be able to use?
Yes, the opioid risk tool is pretty simple. It's easy to use, and unfortunately, some doctors, because they have these misconceptions that these are very difficult patients, and occasionally they can be difficult, but some of the things have to do with us and what we do and how we perceive the patient in chronic pain. So these tools are easily available. They can be eased very simply. I always look into diabetes patients. We do a hemoglobin A1C, so the opioid risk tool would be someone for chronic pain. We do other labs. We look into various medications that are available and educational materials. And then for the chronic pain patients, we really don't do anything differently. We just use different tools. And I think if family physicians are more familiar with these tools, they actually will be able to help these patients and will also have less frustrations for themselves. For themselves, and this frustration, unfortunately, kind of gets transferred to the patient as well. So there are good studies that show that family doctors are frustrated with these patients, and patients, vice versa, are frustrated with family doctors concerning that problem.
So if family doctors prescribe about half of the opioids, would changes in practice or changes in assumptions cause that to be diminished and switch to alternatives or not?
Yes, I think the educational measures should include, you know, what other options do we have than just use a quick opioid to treat whatever is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we as physicians, I think we want to do good for our patients, and I think physicians inherently want to do the right thing. Now, sometimes that right thing is a little bit tougher to do because we may not quite know, and we have these misconceptions, and we really don't want to do this, mm-hmm. but I think ultimately we want to do the right thing. And the right thing to do is, at a time where we deal with opioid crisis, and we're responsible for 50% of the opioids that are being prescribed, I think is to integrate these tools and look at our patients a little bit closer and advise them and educate them accordingly.
So in family medicine, you have a lot of time restraints. It's busy. Many mm-hmm. of the people coming in have complex problems, many problems. And if they have pain and you have CDC guidelines, how do you manage assessment of a complex pain?
It's a very good question, and we are indeed faced with time shortage, and we have to address so many issues. Many of the complaints I'm hearing by primary care physician, well, I don't have the time to deal with this. Okay, I have 20 minutes, and there's no way for me to do all of this. Well, there are some tricks of the trade, one of which is where you can separate the visits. So you start with a patient, you find out, oh, this patient has chronic pain. Well, now you have two choices. You can address it that visit, or you can address it to a part this visit. So you can actually change one visit to two or three visits. Say, well, we need to talk about this. I want to talk about this because I think we can make a difference for you, but I can't do it in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. So we can start. I have actually some material prepared. So we have a special history and physical data sheet just for patients with chronic pain. We ask all the important questions and has all these tools integrated, and you give it to the patient and you can move on that visit with some other issues and you bring it back to another visit. Or you have a special mm-hmm. time in your day where you see some more complex patients, and of course chronic pain patients are more complex. You bring them in at the end of the day where you can kind of swap over maybe a little bit later and can finish a whole visit that way. That's expectation. Timing expectation. There's another expectation we talked a little bit about, which is the expectation of the patient to get rid of the pain. Mm-hmm. Yes, ultimately we all want to get rid of our pain. But as life happens and things happen, we survive accidents, trauma, and many other things in our lives, it's not going to happen. Okay, so we as physicians should manage this proactively. We cannot cure it, but we can help you to manage it and continue to live your life and enjoy your life.
Doctors are trained to help people and relieve suffering and pain and suffering. A person comes in and complaining of extreme pain, and they'll say, this works. Can you write me a prescription for this? And you might not agree. How do you learn to say no?
One of the things that doctors are really afraid of is to say no. So the patient says, well, this is, you ask the question, this is the only thing that helps me. But you have cocaine addiction in your history, everybody in your family was an alcoholic. This is not the right drug for you. This will get you into trouble down the road. I think doctors do have to allow them to say no. We do this in a very tactful manner. We do it after we listen to the patient and make sure that the patient was heard and understands where we're coming from. We use laws and guidelines that guide us that we cannot prescribe these medications, and we present it to the patients. And several of them will say, well, then maybe I have to find a new doctor, and that is okay too. We as doctors have to allow that as well. But I think you want to do the right thing as a physician, and if you very clearly understand this is the wrong thing, I don't think you want to do that with your patients. So you kind of manage that as well. And I think educational, I'm very involved in education, unfortunately does not train doctors to say no, we want to help our patients. So no is kind of not really what we're training, but we're doing a better job now and actually allowing patients to voice their disagreements, but ultimately we're in charge and have to say no. And we do this in a tactful manner.
Thank you.
And usually patients respond to this way of addressing the issue. Occasionally you will have a patient that will not like the answer. And if it escalates to even shouting or maybe even violence, you need to de-escalate the situation, may have to remove yourself from the room, and you may have to get help. So, but in 28 years of practice, I've seen this very rarely.
That's good.
Yes. So usually the patient may actually remove themselves of the room and say, well, if I don't get opioids, then I'm out of here. And then I obviously can't work with the patient and help the patient. I think for doctors,
it's like giving bad news.
That's right. And for doctors, it's kind of frustrating because here's someone we wanted to help and they don't want our help. Okay, for whatever reason. And I think doctors have to allow themselves to they need to be fine with that. Mm-hmm. This is not what the doctor is all about. Yes, we want to help, but we want to do it in the right way.
Does family medicine have enough in the way of prescribing guidelines so that you can say, well, the American Academy says this, or do you revert to the CDC or the state guidelines? What is the kind of guideline that a patient will understand or that you like to communicate?
Yeah, we do have various guidelines. The guidelines have been created by other organizations, mainly some of the pain management organizations that have been around for years. However, it's always hard to change habits. Mm-hmm. Doctors get into a habit, and changing that is hard. So the federal government came in with the CDC guidelines in 2016 to kind of remind doctors to pay more attention to what we're doing and how we're prescribing opioids. And they very clearly looked into the amount of opioids that are being prescribed. And we do use those guidelines in our practice and trying to reduce opioids. And for the practice and physicians, as I've seen it, actually lesser seems to be more and better for the patients. One of the problems is doctors have not been trained to wean patients of opioids. So, and it's quite simple. And the details concerning weaning is the majority of pain management doctors use 10% mm-hmm. of the opiate dose per week. And when you get below 50%, you may reduce it maybe to every 2 weeks, or maybe slower if they have been on very, very high doses. Another way of doing this is to use 25% per month until you get about to 50% or 25%, and you can kind of adjust it. And some of these patients may take a half a year. Mm-hmm. And I had several where it took us 2 years to get them off completely. But these patients actually were very appreciative and were very glad to be off the medication. I had others where we reached a level where the pain got so severe that we actually had to keep the dose and maybe kind of went up a little bit and really proved that they do need this medication. And the other medication that we use called adjunct medications weren't really controlling the pain so they could stay functional. I mean, we're talking about professional people, we're talking about retired people, we're talking about all kind of people. Mm-hmm. And they do want to participate in their life, and they do want to be there for, you know, the birthdays and the celebrations of the family, and we are able to do that for them. We help them to manage that well.
So you have to sit in the patient's shoes, you have to feel what they're feeling through them and understand it and make the most informed decisions that you can together.
Yes, and I think family doctors are involved in chronic care management, and one of the major aspects of chronic care management is to really activate the patient. Often in our medical society, we just do tests and we poke and probe the patient, but we don't talk to them. And then as we talk to them and activate the patient, so it's all passive stuff. We give the patient something they can participate in actively. We get them back out of the shell. Chronic pain kind of makes you shrink and you don't want to do anything. You don't want to participate in anything. And we help them to get back out of this and be an active member of participating in them managing their own pain. Mm-hmm. That's actually one of the aspects where doctors get very frustrated. They take the pain of their patients on their shoulder and feel it. And you can do that to a degree, but if you continue doing this, I mean, you get really burned out. And that's one of the things for physicians to understand. There's empathy that's appropriate, and then there's the next step where you're taking all the pain mm-hmm. of your patients, which is not healthy to you nor the patients because it will wear you out. So you should do some burnout preventive things, you know, enjoy your own life, meditation, listen to music, do something outside of medicine. And, you know, I say, well, that's from someone, my wife would look at me, she would say, well, you know, what all you do? Well, I do yard work. So I love being outside and do the yard work, and it's my release. It's mm-hmm. it's wonderful. I can exactly determine what I want, where I put the plant and where not. So it's a wonderful thing. So I recommend yard work.
So I want to thank you for being here, and I want to thank everyone for being here with Dr. Siegfried Schmidt and talking about family medicine and practice and opioid guidelines. Thank you so much for joining us. I have with me today the residency director of the University of South Florida, Hassan Mir, who's an expert on trauma and also the director of orthopedic trauma research at the Florida Orthopedic Institute. In addition to his interest in orthopedic surgery trauma, he's an expert on pain and pain guidelines, which all the other experts here said we need help with.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
Thank you. So, I mean, most experts, whether we had dental experts, family medicine experts, PA experts, every expert said we need help with guidelines. So not one size fits all, but what kind of guideline help can you give us in understanding acute guidelines?
Sure. So there are several guidelines from multiple societies out there that deal with various aspects of pain control. In fact, the CDC published guidelines a few years ago dealing with the management of chronic pain. What we've noted in our subspecialty of orthopedics is that there's not a lot out there to deal with acute mm-hmm. pain control, especially from musculoskeletal injury. So within our realm of orthopedics, we're a pretty small subspecialty overall. We're about 2% of all physicians, so only about 20,000 orthopedists in the US. However, when you look at healthcare overall, I think that our field of musculoskeletal medicine has a major role in that the vast majority of family care offices or primary care doctors and pediatricians, roughly half of their clinics can be filled with musculoskeletal complaints from patients. Also in the emergency department, there can be a huge number of patients who show up with musculoskeletal pain, whether it be from acute injury or from long-standing chronic conditions. So I certainly think that guidelines from our specialty as being musculoskeletal experts can go a long way towards helping other physicians and other prescribers, whether it be PAs or NPs, to help them manage various conditions.
So they might streamline what choices doctors might make, as well as help them explain those choices to the patient.
Right. I think that guidelines are a great starting point to have those discussions. I think that physicians in general are fairly independent-minded, especially my surgical colleagues, and don't necessarily like mandates. What's happened in response to the opioid epidemic is a lot of states have come out with prescribing mandates and limits and so forth. And I think that as specialty societies and as physicians, it would be more helpful for us to have clinical practice guidelines that are a starting point and help you with making these decisions of how to treat patients and not really a one-size-fits-all approach. Still leaving room for physicians to practice the art of medicine, but at least giving you a starting point, whether it be for managing conditions with medications, with opioids being one part of those that medication list, but also thinking about the patient as a whole and having cognitive strategies, having system strategies, having physical strategies. I think that when you have a set of guidelines that encompasses all of these things, it will certainly go towards helping physicians manage patients' pain, whether from acute conditions or chronic conditions.
Other physician groups look to you and they say, orthopedic surgeons are experts on pain, especially acute conditions. So even if a family physician might manage a finger break, they'd look to you for guidelines about what do you give for a broken finger. And if somebody had an accident, they would go back usually to family physician after a major bone break, and they need to understand what your guidelines would include and what they should continue and support with their patients.
Right. So that's absolutely correct in that part of what's led to the opioid epidemic is sometimes there's too many cooks in the kitchen. We all share patients, and historically there weren't these databases that existed, and patients may have been getting prescriptions and different guidance from different physicians. So part of the efforts that we've put forth with the Orthopedic Trauma Association and these guidelines for acute pain management is to make recommendations for what a taper looks like for opioids for these varying conditions, whether it be a major surgery, a minor surgery, or a non-operative injury. And then also allowing for alternative treatments, in that historically, people shied away from using non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for fractures for concern that it may not allow the fracture to heal, but we know that that's not necessarily the case. And so now, personally, in my practice, and there's several orthopedic surgeons out there now who give all of our patients anti-inflammatories acutely after an injury without any detriment to their bony healing. So there's different things like that that can go a long way to dispelling myths and to helping patients control their pain and not depend on opioid monotherapy to do so.
That's really an interesting addition to our thinking, because sometimes these old wives' tales, like anti-inflammatory wives' tales, just have a life of their own. There's really no evidence. There's maybe a few patients out of 100 for which you might think otherwise.
Right, so the only patients that I wouldn't use an anti-inflammatory in now are patients at high risk for being on anti-inflammatories with significant ulcers or significant renal disease, or those who are at high risk for a fracture not healing. Say I'm treating them for a fracture that didn't heal the first time, or they're a poorly controlled diabetic or a heavy smoker. So in those instances, maybe you consider going away from those medications. But in general, I think they're safe for the vast majority of our patients and we use them. And then moving beyond drugs, of course, is the cognitive side, which I think it's kind of odd, and a lot of the folks here have thought it odd, I think, that an orthopedic surgeon is talking about the touchy-feely aspects of medicine.
We didn't think it was odd. We thought it was great. We said, gee, this is a new age.
Right, but to talk to patients as if they're more than just an injury or more than just the bone, right? There's a whole person there, and I think that if you look at other aspects of patient care, then that can certainly help with managing their pain.
The use of ice and heat, how do you understand that?
So there's really good evidence on cryotherapy and being an adjunct to pain control. And a lot of times people ask us, well, does it work through the splint or the cast? And it actually does. It's been proven in multiple studies now that the ice still works even through the splint or the cast, because that's one of those myths that we mentioned earlier that people think it doesn't work if I have a cast on. No, it still works.
How did the CDC guidelines relate to your own society guidelines?
So the CDC guidelines that were put out in 2016 mainly dealt with chronic pain. And while there were some musculoskeletal issues in there, it didn't really address what to do with patients with acute post-surgical pain or acute injury. So our group with the Orthopedic Trauma Association really wanted to come together and put together guidelines to address these scenarios. And they have been vetted and reviewed, and they will be published soon. And we do plan to make them open access so they're available not only for orthopedists to utilize, but for all subspecialists to utilize, whether it's primary care or ER or anyone who's managing our patients.
Did you put together anything that doctors who treat or evaluate pain might use as a toolkit?
Certainly. So with the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, on our website there are toolkits available that help to evaluate patients with risk assessment, with difficult conversations. There's several resources available there on our website.
I've heard you speak, and you've made everyone in the audience think about the whole person. And even orthopedic surgeons must be saying, what's with this? I thought the person was equal to the x-ray.
Yeah, so as I mentioned in our discussions earlier today, we actually have had symposia at some of our national conferences that are titled, It's More Than Just the X-Ray. And so this is to get our colleagues to think beyond the immediate result. A lot of us went into orthopedics because of the instant gratification. You see something broken, you fix it, you move on, and have the patient moves on to a successful outcome. But part of that process is to help patients through this in managing their pain. And you have to realize that there's a whole person attached to this. They can have potential life stressors going on. Nobody really plans to wreck their motorcycle or break their wrist in a fall. So it's going to impact their ability to earn a living. It's going to impact their ability to just manage their lives. And there can also be post-traumatic stress involved with some of these situations. There can be their own personal history of substance abuse or prior history of opioid use or chronic pain. There can be a whole host of things that go into this. So just having simple discussions with your patients, I think we can sometimes realize that we're not actually treating pain necessarily when we prescribe opioids or prescribe other medications. We may actually be treating anxiety or depression. And while we're not experts at treating those conditions, we can recognize them. We're all physicians. I think that if we just spend the time to talk to our patients, we can uncover other issues and at least direct our patients to where they will best be managed.
So it really isn't the end of orthopedic surgery or acute intervention to have restrictions on prescribing?
No, I mean, I think that we do prescribe as part of our practices. It's our responsibility to manage our patient's pain postoperatively, but only to a certain point. That's where some of these guidelines help, in that we prescribe and we taper down. And once you get to a certain endpoint, if the pain is persisting, you really have to dig and figure out, is this really still pain? There's obviously a lot of individual variability in this, right? There's a difference between nociception, which is just a stimulus that triggers a nerve ending and sends a signal to your brain, and what we perceive as pain. You and I could each get hit in the kneecap right now, and we may respond completely differently with our pain response based on our own physiology, based on our own backgrounds, our own level of stoicism. There's a lot of cultural things that go into pain as well. So I think that individualizing those things goes a long way into treating our patients as a whole. But to keep it simple for practicing clinicians and busy practices, just talking to patients for a couple of minutes will save you and your staff potentially several phone calls and a lot of pain down the road. And just helping with regular life stuff, whether it's return to work forms or a temporary handicap tag, or just talking to patients about how they're dealing with things, can go a long way towards helping them alleviate some of the anxiety and depression that may be masking itself as a complaint of pain.
So it's really interesting for me that within your guidelines, you almost have built in addiction medicine principles of tapering and discontinuation and switching. And that's novel. It always seemed to me that if someone had an accident or an orthopedic surgical procedure, that they were just given so many opioids that they wouldn't even remember to call their orthopedic surgeon again, let alone at night.
Yeah, well, that was the historical practice. It was just easier to write a huge prescription with a giant number of opioids. It saved you the hassle of dealing with patient calls or patient complaints. But I think we've realized with the current epidemic that we have to prescribe more responsibly, and that that we have to limit the number of opioids we use and use alternative medications. Also, with state laws in many states, you can't prescribe the numbers that you did before. So it requires you to be a more complete physician and discuss some of these other issues.
So is it safe to say that after a couple of weeks, a person with persistent pain complaints has something different going on?
It's possible. Now, certainly you don't want to neglect real issues that could be going on. Surgeries can have complications, or some people may just have a longer lasting pain response. They may be going through rehab, et cetera, that's causing it. But I think that there certainly can be other things such as anxiety or depression or life issues that are manifesting themselves as pain. I think that in the vast majority of my patients now, since we've gone to these newer protocols, a lot of times after a few weeks, many of them are weaned off of opioids and instead are asking for refills of anti-inflammatories or acetaminophen, which we actually give as prescriptions for our patients. That's been a huge change in our practice, is that when you give a true prescription for an anti-inflammatory or acetaminophen, patients realize that these are true medications and not just over-the-counter, buy them and take them. They're actually medicines that we're prescribing for pain relief, and they appreciate that more. There certainly is a psychological effect to giving prescriptions for these medications.
So what would that prescription look like if I was to write one?
So for example, instead of just telling the patient, just go get some Advil or Tylenol and take it, we'll actually prescribe the Tylenol scheduled, 1,000 milligrams, Q12 hours or so, especially if they're still taking a combination opioid to make sure we stay within the safe bounds of Tylenol. And then for Advil, 600 milligrams, PO, Q, 6 hours. Just schedule it and try to stay within safe bounds and try to tell them about the potential side effects if you are prescribing the medications.
Would that cost them more?
It could actually potentially cost them less, because when you tell them just to go to the drugstore and buy it on their own, it's cash out of pocket, versus if it's a prescription, it may potentially be filled by their insurance. I know certainly when it's a workers' compensation case that'll be covered by through their workers' compensation.
I'm trying to figure out what you mean by prescribing responsibly.
So I think that goes into how we write our prescriptions and how we individualize treatment for our patients. So as far as individualizing treatment for our patients, I think it's great to have guidelines, but it can't be one size fits all. I think that there are different levels of injury that people sustain. So for example, in our Orthopedic Trauma Association guidelines, we're gonna have it tiered for major injury or surgery, minor injury or surgery, and then non-operative injuries. So there'll be different tiered levels of what we recommend as tapers. And within those, there'll be an inpatient recommendation and then outpatient recommendations with tapers.
So like for major, you'd mean like break your hip?
Break your hip, break your femur, break your pelvis. So those sort of major injuries after a motorcycle wreck or a major car accident.
So how would that be handled, do you think?
So that typically on the inpatient side is going to be both multimodal and multi-drug. So I think that that's an important distinction to make, is that people sometimes confuse multimodal, which is multiple modalities, including physical modalities such as ice, elevation, compression, potentially alternative therapies such as aromatherapy, music therapy, all of these things which are evidence-based and really make a difference, versus multi-drug, which is, you know, as we described, using opioids as just one component of an armamentarium of anti-inflammatories, gabapentin, Tylenol, regional or field blocks to help with patients' pain control.
And so that would be one kind of accident or injury, and then you could have carpal tunnel repair, or you break a, I guess, a wrist. Would that be considered more minor?
Right, so that would be something more minor. And for those, a lot of those procedures are done outpatient, and so we would recommend for those to have minimal to no opioids or and a really limited amount. And obviously you have to individualize based on the patient, and again, that's where the guidelines allow clinical judgment from the physician. And you also have to be cognizant of the state that you practice in, because we all have to are legally bound by our state laws.
Thanks. So for the these guidelines that your society is working on, what kinds of ranges do you have for opioid prescribing?
So what we've tried to do in our guidelines now is to change the way that we write our prescriptions. In the past, it was pretty common that we would allow patients to take 1 to 2 pills every 4 to 6 hours and kind of leave it at their discretion. And for the vast majority of patients or their families, they would tend to max out the doses and minimize the time, so they actually use their prescription faster than what we really intended. So now I think our big push is to recommend that folks prescribe precisely and only write for one pill for the exact time interval that you really want them to take it, and then taper that down week to week.
So that's a big change.
That is a big change. I think that that it eliminates some of the variability that existed, and you know, it takes away a little bit of the confusion for patients sometimes, because sometimes they don't know what to do, and they just know they're hurting, and they don't know if they should take one or two, or how, if they should take it every 4 hours or 6 hours. So it helps eliminate some of the variability, and especially now with using multiple different types of medications and multiple modalities and telling them to stagger the doses for the different medications at different times, it's certainly having a profound effect, because we're not using opioids as monotherapy anymore. We're using multiple types of medications on different schedules.
So do you expect like other orthopedic surgeons to adopt prescription, you know, like guidelines that are exact and precise?
I certainly hope so. I think that in talking with several colleagues around the country who have already enacted this in their practices and their groups, it's had a major impact in their practices, and especially with their groups. It actually is it's not that much work to meet with your partners mm-hmm. and set up a practice guideline based on your own subspecialty, your own locality. And then it really cuts down the work on your office staff and on the whole process. It makes it easier for patients because they understand the plan. It's a lot easier in the elective setting when you can really lay this out, but even the acute trauma setting, you can lay it out. And it goes a long way towards making things streamlined and understandable so patients have a good expectation of what's going to happen.
No, I can see how that makes a great deal of sense. I just was wondering about the adoption. We'll see.
The adoption, we'll see. I think I'm a hard-headed bone doc, just like the rest of us out there. But once we did the work and actually started doing it, it actually has made our lives easier. So I hope that a lot of colleagues in orthopedics and other surgical subspecialties, and then a lot of our colleagues in primary care or the emergency department will look at these guidelines and from the standpoint that it'll make practice easier to have something to fall back on. Not a mandate, but something that you can fall back on to help guide your own clinical practice.
No, I mean, it makes a lot of sense for me. I mean, is it one or is it three? Is it one or is it two? Is it, I mean, it's a big 100% difference.
Yeah, I think when you prescribe precisely, it eliminates the doubt and the confusion.
Thank you, Hassan, for being here and sharing your insights on acute management of pain and pain guidelines.
Thank you very much for having me.